Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Governor Kathy Hochul delivered her fifth State of the State yesterday, a speech many observers say doubled as a soft launch for her 2026 re-election campaign. To help us break down what stood out, what was missing, and what it means for New Yorkers, we'll be joined by our Radio Catskill reporters who followed the speech closely, Jason Dole, Kimberly Izar, and Patricio Rubio. Staggering amounts of alcohol and serious nation building. Historian Dr. Kirsten Wood joins us to explain how taverns helped shape early America. And Farewell Party 2025, an annual musical tribute to the artists we lost. Happening Friday at the Muse in Rosendale, we'll get a preview from culture reporter Valerie Manzi after this hour's news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump is calling on NATO to support his wish to take over Greenland, and he says anything less than that would be unacceptable. This hours before Vice President Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio are scheduled to meet today at the White House with the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland over Trump's threats. NPR's Franco Ordonez has more.
The Danish officials requested the meeting with the Secretary of State Marco Rubio after President Trump renewed his push to take over Greenland by military force if necessary. President Trump and his top aides have repeatedly claimed that control of Greenland is a national security issue for the United States, citing Russian and Chinese activity in the region. He claims that if the U.S. doesn't take control of the territory, Russia or China will, and that he can't allow that to happen. Greenland's prime minister says the island territory wants to remain with Denmark and will face a geopolitical crisis if it has to choose between the U.S. and Denmark. The Danish prime minister says the future of NATO is at stake. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
New York's Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul is proposing more restrictions on federal immigration agents operating in the state. Walter Wuthman of member station WNYC has more.
New York already has several laws limiting state and local police from assisting ICE in civil immigration arrests. Now Hochul wants to bar immigration agents from entering schools, hospitals, and houses of worship without an official warrant.
New York will not allow the use of state resources to assist in federal immigration raids on people who have not committed serious crimes.
Hochul is also supporting a proposal that would allow people to sue ICE agents in state court for injuries or property damage. Republicans say police need to be able to work with ICE to enforce the law. For NPR News, I'm Walter Wuthman in Albany, New York.
Stocks opened lower this morning as the National Association of Realtors reported an uptick in home sales last month. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Sales of existing homes rose more than 5% in December compared to the previous month. Mortgage rates have fallen from nearly 7% a year ago to just over 6% today. The average selling price for a home last month was just over $405,000. A new report from the Commerce Department says retail sales picked up in November. Consumer spending at restaurants, stores, and gas stations rose by 0.6% during the month. Thanks to President Trump's tariffs, the U.S. is buying less from China, but China's finding plenty of other buyers around the world. Exports from the world's second largest economy rose 5.5% last year, and China's trade surplus grew to a record $1.2 trillion. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street's trading lower at this hour. The Dow is down 204 points. The Nasdaq is down 308. The S&P 500 down 56. This is NPR. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney is in Beijing for a multi-day visit to China to talk with President Xi Jinping about new markets for Canadian goods. This after relations with the U.S. soured after President Trump said he wanted to annex Canada. Diplomatic relations between China and Canada fell apart in 2018 when, at the request of the U.S., Canada arrested a senior executive of the Chinese telecom firm Huawei and the daughter of its founder. China responded, arresting two Canadians on national security charges. They were released. Climate scientists say 2025 was the third warmest year on record. NPR's Jeff Brady has more.
Countries have agreed to try to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius to avoid more extreme storms, rainfall, and heat waves. Samantha Burgess with the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts says the Earth has nearly reached that.
The globe has warmed by about 1.4 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial level. And if warming continues at the same average rate experienced over the last 15 years, then we will reach 1.5 degree level by the end of this decade.
2024 was the hottest year in the past 11 years of all set records. The primary driver for the hotter climate is rising concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, mostly from human activity such as burning fossil fuels. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
And again on Wall Street, the Dow is down 203 points. The Nasdaq is down 294. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Governor Kathy Hochul gave her fifth State of the State speech yesterday. She highlighted her proposals to lower the cost of living and also promised to defend New Yorkers from overreach by the Trump administration. Samuel King with the New York Public News Network reports the address comes as Hochul is running for re-election.
Two of Governor Hochul's topics during her speech drew sustained standing ovations. One was her plan for child care.
And this plan will ultimately deliver universal child care for every single family in New York. Full stop. Full stop. Now the work has already begun.
The other came when she discussed ICE. Her State of the State proposals include legislation allowing New Yorkers to sue in state court if federal officers violate a person's constitutional rights.
Protecting New Yorkers also means this: standing up to ICE agents who abuse their power.
That illustrated a recurring theme during her speech in the Hart Theater at the Egg in Albany, fighting back against powers that be, a tendency she says dates back to the nation's founding 250 years ago.
It's that resilience, that strength, that spirit, that willingness to fight for a better future that was born in secret meetings in the taverns of Albany in New York City, charting a path forward under the weight of an oppressive power. Sound familiar?
The other theme, affordability. As Hochul outlined proposals to reduce utility bills, lower home and auto insurance costs, and create more affordable housing.
Parents, veterans, the disabled, seniors, they all need relief.
Local officials like Mayor Mike Ferguson of Fredonia in Western New York made the trip to Albany for the speech. He welcomed Hochul's proposal to streamline the environmental review process for certain housing projects.
And that's going to save buyers thousands upon thousands of dollars, not to mention the amount of time it's going to cut in the buying process.
The speech comes as Hochul embarks on a re-election campaign with a Republican challenger, Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman, on her right, and a challenger within her own party, Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado, running on her left. Former Lieutenant Governor Bob Duffy, who is now the president and CEO of the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce, said Hochul has a balancing act between those who say she is going too far with some proposals like child care and those who say she's retreating on some issues, like the environment.
And so a lot of things people may take issue with, but I think she's on spot on. And here's a difficult thing. She's in an election year. She's trying to be pulled far, far left. The state is not far left. I think the state is mostly moderate.
Meanwhile, Republicans in the legislature, like Assembly Minority Leader Will Barclay of Oswego County, said they were largely skeptical of the governor's proposals and the focus on Washington.
It's hard for her probably to admit that Democrats have been one-party rule here in Albany for over a decade. So many of the big problems we have in New York, namely affordability, I think can be laid at the footsteps or the feet of the governor and her Democratic colleagues.
Now the work of turning her proposals into law begins. The governor will unveil her executive budget proposal next week. In Albany, I'm Samuel King for the New York Public News Network.
And to help us break down what stood out in the speech, I'm joined in the studio live by our Radio Catskill reporters who followed the speech closely, Jason Dole, Kimberly Izar, and Patricio Rubio. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Just overall, a big picture question. What do you think was the overarching message that Hochul seemed to be sending with this speech when you kind of step back from the policy details? Jason?
Re-elect Governor Kathy Hochul. I think that was a big mission. I mean, honestly, that's what she's going to be doing in her re-election year, but
It did seem that she was trying to present the image of stability and accomplishment above anything else. And I think that does tie in with the reelection plan.
For me, I think the big picture was not backing down amidst the federal cuts. I mean, Hochul is up against a lot of challenges with under the backdrop of a lot of Trump's federal cuts. I mean, just this past week, we saw the federal cuts to childcare, for example. And as we heard yesterday, a big topic for her is going to be childcare this year.
And what's that for you?
I agree with all of that. It's really that we're all in this together. And that we're all New Yorkers, and sort of she wants to sort of help protect the state more with some of the policies that she's proposed.
I want to point out the governor's own branding, though. If you compare last year to this year, last year's overall theme and heading for the speech was fighting for your family. Yesterday's was your family is my fight. That was one of her lead lines.
Well, also, she seemed to have a law and order shift in a way. Like previously, she had talked a lot about bail and discovery laws. And this year, she really didn't. You know, she focused on the affordability side of it and the other side.
When that came up in my conversation with Chris Bragg from New York Focus yesterday, he kind of couched that observation within my question of how people are looking at how is the governor going to work with Zohran Mamdani as mayor of New York City, looking at the left-right politics of that. That's when he made that observation, which I thought was interesting. But yeah, I feel like we have moved away from the bail reform, which was one of the major issues when she came in office. I feel like the governor really felt the last few years she had to be stronger on a law enforcement and when it came to safety. But what she had to say about safety yesterday was less about law enforcement, and it was a bit more nuanced. So she still had safety initiatives to talk about.
And to Kim's point and to your point, in the overarching issue of safety and law enforcement, it seemed to be targeted more about immigration at the federal level. And one of the biggest reactions during her State of the State was about immigration. What did Governor Hochul say about that, Patricio?
On immigration, the governor is proposing to draw, I believe, a firmer boundaries around federal enforcement actions in New York. One of the key proposals would require immigration officers to attain judicial warrant before carrying out enforcement in what the state defines as sensitive locations, including schools and hospitals and houses of worship. And Hochul's argument is that without these protections, people can fear and be discouraged from seeking medical care or sending their kids to school or accessing, you know, basic services. And it's, you know, state officials have warned that this kind of avoidance doesn't affect immigrant families, but could undermine public health and safety more broadly.
Yeah, she said that the state will not use resources to support federal immigration raids on non-criminals, and she criticized the Trump administration and ICE agents, saying they've overstepped boundaries. This is all in the backdrop, as you mentioned, Kim, of all of the things that are going on at a national level. Of course, the tragedy in Minnesota of Renee Good being shot by an ICE agent. But locally in our backyard, which you reported on, the ICE detention facility, that's a processing facility that's proposed in the town of Chester in Orange County.
Yeah, and I think that's something that Hochul lifted up yesterday was none of this is happening in a vacuum, right? Like when we talk about immigration, she talked about not allowing ICE agents into schools and hospitals. When she was talking about energy, for example, which was another big talking point that we'll get into, she was also talking about affordability.
Yeah, and Jason, I want to talk about the bigger issue of Trump and the Trump administration. She used the administration and Trump as a foil during this speech.
Right, and I feel like there was a bit more of that positioning and using as a foil than there was details. Of course, State of the State address isn't going to have necessarily a lot of details, but I was really listening for specific policies about how is New York State going to deal with the administration in Washington, D.C., and I felt like I heard a lot more pros about that right out of the gate saying, hey, you New Yorkers have always been a rebellious lot, and like going back to the fight for democracy at the nation's founding and positing the divide between New York State and the federal government and couching it in that context, which is all really interesting. But, you know, we spent, since the legislature disbanded last summer, we spent 6 months wondering, were they going to come back together to patch the giant $300 billion hole that additional federal cuts put in the New York State budget? A lot of that might be addressed during the coming budgeting process, but I thought we might have heard just a little bit more about direct response from the state to actions from the Trump administration.
Yeah, it seems like using it as some applause lines in a way. I mean, you expect that in a State of the State speech like this. Also, though, Hochul has been known to be working with the administration when it comes to certain policies and areas, energy being one of them, Kim. What did you hear during the speech when it came to energy and environment? So, or what didn't you hear?
Yeah, I would say that for me, the biggest through line was affordability for New Yorkers. And that did not feel more front and center than when she was talking about energy. She said how the average New Yorker pays about $1,700 a year just to keep the lights on. And she's been working with everyday New Yorkers on making their homes more energy efficient and, you know, protecting them from exorbitant rate hikes. But to Jason's point, I was also listening for the specifics on how that was done. And I didn't really hear too much of that. She talked of one thing that I thought was interesting was she talked about the role that energy companies play. She said that large companies like data centers, which are becoming more and more prominent here in New York State, have to pay their fair share of energy. And so that would mean that, you know, everyday New Yorkers, taxpayers, consumers aren't shouldering the costs of those bills. But the specifics of how lawmakers are going to stop the rate hikes that so many residents, even here in Sullivan County, have been telling us about, those specifics didn't really shine through.
And, you know, these emphasis on affordability issues, childcare costs, car insurance, one of those practical things as well, not flashy. But why do you think that kind of agenda resonates now and that shift, as we talked about, from, you know, this law and order focus?
I mean, I think that, as Jason mentioned, this year she's getting reelected. And I think she's also kind of building on that momentum and energy from the Mamdani win, where he really pushed this agenda of affordability, one in droves. And I think that is a message that is really resonating with New Yorkers. And she's seeing how that might translate for her reelection campaign.
Let's talk about New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani. He was highly visible during the speech and mentioned, praised Hochul afterward. How significant is his support? But what political risk do you think come with that? I mean, they've been buddy-buddy recently, showing up together to talk about child care and universal child care in the city, which is supposed to expand to the state.
Yeah, I can touch on that a little bit. I think that it's interesting because when it comes to childcare, this was another thing that was a big point for her. This was actually one of two issues that she got a standing ovation from the crowd. Her big push is to push for universal and affordable childcare across New York State. During the speech, she talked about how the plan starts with announcing with New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani funding childcare for 2,000 children in the city. And statewide, she promises universal pre-K for every 4-year-old. I think it comes with some challenges, though, because at the federal level, we're seeing federal cuts to child care. The Trump administration said that it would freeze funding for child care subsidies in five states, I believe. Mm-hmm. So I think there's going to be some challenges on the implementation of it exactly.
And that's being challenged, and a judge put a temporary hold on all of that for the next 2 weeks, I believe. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with our own Radio Catskill reporters about Governor Kathy Hochul's State of the State speech yesterday. Tricia Rubio, Kimberly Eisauer, and Jason Dole. You know, even though Mamdani was mentioned in the speech, and she has been allying herself with him recently, she also underscored the limits of their partnership a little bit. She didn't mention his goal of making bus routes free, which would cost the MTA close to $1 billion in lost fare revenue. And, you know, a subsidy like that requires Governor Hochul to raise taxes, which she's opposed. So, you know, there are definitely limits to their relationship, and she's going to be putting forth her budget presentation and seeing how these proposals will be funded or not funded. So there is, you know, a partnership, but some limitations to that as well. Jason, I want to talk to you about housing. Did you hear any significant housing issues that the governor brought up?
Yeah, the big line that stood out is the one that she wanted to stand out. But of course, the model of the State of State addresses for each of these topics is tout what you've done and then say what you want to do next on that issue. Okay, this is what we did that's good. Here's how we can do even better. But on housing, she, while touting what they've done, has observed, you know, she wasn't able to get as much support as she wanted for her housing initiatives in recent years, saying, quote, "The loudest voices in opposition said they believed in local control. Okay, let's put that to the test. City of New York, which is a local government, wants to build 500,000 more homes over a decade. I agree. Let them build." So that's really kind of the headline that came out of it. And it's another one of those you could copyright it because it's their branding on their website underneath housing. Now it says, let them build. And they're looking at, you know, proposing the Common Sense Reforms to State Environmental Quality Review Act. The game is to speed up building while preserving environmental safeguards, cutting down on red tape delays, and having clear timelines for environmental review. So that's some of the housing reform. I honestly didn't hear as much about housing as I wanted to, and I look forward to talking to some of our news partners who are more focused on this issue to hear not just what they heard in this, but what housing advocates are saying after this speech.
Patricio, Governor Hochul also announced an AI research center for SUNY Binghamton in the State of the State address. What's behind that, and what else did she say about artificial intelligence?
Yeah, the plan includes, like I say, expanding the AI initiative and launching an independent AI research center at SUNY Binghamton. But she's going on both ends here. Artificial intelligence is she's trying to strike a balance. She laid out a proposal to require clear labeling of AI-generated content, including deepfakes, particularly in elections and political messaging. She stated that the goal is to protect voters from misleading or deceptive synthetic content as AI becomes more widespread use, and also included consumer protections, like limits on deceptive online practices and stronger oversight of how personal data is collected and used, especially when children and teenagers are involved. But like you said before, at the same time, the governor made it clear that she doesn't just want New York to fall behind technology. The plan, like I said, the plan includes expanding the Empire AI initiative and launching the independent AI research at SUNY Binghamton. So it's taken together, these proposals sort of reflect a sort of a broader theme of 2026 State of the State, New York asserting itself and pushing back where state leaders see federal overreach.
Governor Hochul seems to be eager to grapple with fast-changing technologies. She's already banned cell phones in schools, and now these privacy standards aimed at children specific to AI. Kim, did you hear anything, as host of Farm and Country, did you hear anything about agriculture or farming in the speech that you found interesting, or what didn't you hear that you thought should have been in there?
Yeah, Tim, I was listening very intently for that, and I really didn't hear much. In the beginning of her speech, she did mention that farmers are being hit with, you know, the high tariffs that the Trump administration has imposed, as well as the cost of the farming equipment going up. But I really didn't hear any specifics, policies or proposals or solutions about what she's doing to protect farmers, both in the landscape of immigration raids as well as the cost of you know, implementing and operating a farm. To Jason's point, she talked about cutting the red tape when it comes to environmental review processes with housing, but she didn't talk about it when it comes to farming and agriculture.
And she also promised new investments with, quote, without raising taxes, but again, not a lot of detail there. We'll hopefully get more as the budget process goes through in Albany. I wanted to speak a little bit about the progressive pressure she's getting from her left flank a little bit. Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado challenging her in the Democratic primary. He was notably absent from the speech yesterday. I believe you said he was in Syracuse getting pizza, Patricia?
Yeah.
They said on
he's on a listening tour, I believe, right?
Yeah, with David Lombardo and the crew yesterday hosting the live coverage, they said, yeah, he was on a listening tour. And then Chantel right away said, like, not listening to the governor.
Do you think that she addressed any of that? Or as when I spoke to Jimmy Vielcon yesterday from New York Public News Network and WNYC, he said that she's basically just been ignoring him, and that's been her strategy. And did that seem to be the same strategy yesterday as well? Or do you think that there is pressure from progressives for Governor Hochul in this reelection campaign?
I think there's totally pressure for progressives, and where you're seeing that is in how she's approaching some of these policies. But I'm not seeing a lot of like overt olive branches because she's doing this political dance. You guys were talking about Mamdani and Hochul before, and is there a risk for her there? Well, we already know what Republicans want people to think. Brooklyn State Senator says the governor is not steering the ship. She's being steered by extremist socialists who are promising everything for free. So, you know, anytime that she's not doing that, I could just see the dance that she's making of like, you know, I'm going to go against regulation. You know, there's conservatives don't like all the red tape. I'm going to go after that red tape. That's something for you. Hey, we got to do something for families. Progressives concerned about that. Let's do that. That's what I was hearing.
Yeah, I agree. I think that she's being extremely strategic about how she is aligning with the progressive agenda amidst her reelection campaign. We heard her talk about how she's working with New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani, but she didn't really, she mentioned it and then she kind of moved on, yeah. Right?
And we got some reaction from Assemblymember Paula Kay, who represents District 100 in our listening area. What did Representative Assemblymember Kay say?
With a lot of things that Hochul was saying, but she like we brought up here, she just wants more details about what's going on. And more about childcare and how that's sort of going to roll out. And one thing I want to bring up about Mamdani, we talked about this before Mamdani got elected, what effect his election will bring to the rest of New York State. And I think we're starting to see that a little bit. One thing he even noted was in the video thumbnail of the 2026 State of the State looked like Mamdani's promotion when he was running for mayor. So even like that look is sort of coming up, and it's sort of I had a feeling that maybe they're just jumping on his coattails because he's so popular in New York City, and maybe you know try to grab on that popularity for her reelection.
And of course, not surprising, Republican leaders in the state blasted her. Will Barclay, the Assembly Republican leader, said, quote, every State of the State address is a reminder that actions speak louder than words. And this year's presentation was no different. Until residents see a positive change in their day-to-day lives, lower costs, safer communities, and reversing the alarming out-migration trend, rhetoric alone will not be enough. Senator Peter Oberrocker, who represents our listening area in New York State's Senate District 51, said, quote, today, during her State of the State address, Governor Hochul spoke about affordability. I guess that's something. But after years of rising costs and families leaving New York, words just aren't enough. Upstate families need lower energy bills, which is why I've introduced the Utility Ratepayer Bill of Rights. We need affordable housing and safe communities, which is why I fought for and passed residential construction tax exemption. He goes on to say other things that he did in that statement.
As much as Governor Hochul's speech is about reelect Governor Kathy Hochul, Senator Oberacker's speech was even more about, hey, I'm running for Congress.
Right. Elect me. He's running for New York's 19th district, which is currently held by Congressman Josh Riley. So an eventful 2026 ahead of us. Before we go, as budget negotiations begin in Albany, what do you think listeners should watch for to see whether this governor's State of the State speech translates into real policy? Patricia?
I think you have to look at how she's going to respond to the federal cuts. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to really reshape the budget going forward. You know, the federal government keeps throwing these wrenches into the whole mix. It's sort of mixing things up. And when you have these plans, it's also, they got to sort of rethink and restep the budget.
Kim?
For me, I'm really looking at how she's going to respond when it comes to child care and health care. This year is the year when we're really going to see the immediate impacts of the One Big Beautiful Bill's health care cuts, and I'm very curious to see how that's going to translate at the state level.
And rather than pick an issue, I'm just going to talk about the process. What I will advise people to watch is who's making noise during the budgeting process, because this budgeting process is a chance for people to have a say on legislation, whether that's non-governmental advocates on the ground or big money corporate lobbyists. This is when they're all going to weigh in. And that's why you're going to hear me talking to our news partners on air saying, what are people on the ground saying? Who likes this idea? Who doesn't like this idea?
And we'll be covering all of the developments out of Albany through our partnerships with New York Public News Network and all of our news partners, New York Focus, and others, of course, and on our own programming. However, tonight on the local edition, wanted to point out something coming up. Patricio, you've got a great, Kim, you did this interview, I think, with the Evergreen Meadow. Can you talk a little bit about that coming up?
Yeah, I chatted with Stacey and Adrian Jensen over at Evergreen Meadow Services. They just received a really exciting $2 million investment from New York Governor Kathy Hochul to construct the middle school and residential program at on their campus in Rock Hill, as well as some exciting new developments. So definitely tune into the local edition this evening.
Just remind folks what they do there at Evergreen.
Oh, yes. They're a nonprofit serving at-risk girls with trauma backgrounds in Sullivan County, but also across New York State.
All right. Our impressive nonstop reporting team, Patricia Rubio, Kimberly Izar, and Jason Dole, thank you all so much for your reactions to this and all of your reporting. Again, the local edition tonight at 6. Also, there will be more of a reaction to the governor's State of the State address on the Capitol Press Room coming up today at 1 on Radio Catskill. We'll take a break, and when we come back, they weren't just places to drink. Early American taverns were hubs of business, politics, and power. Maybe we would have been discussing this in a tavern in the 19th century. This Sunday, historian Dr. Kirsten Wood reveals what happened inside America's first taverns, coming up on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view sci-fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. For centuries, taverns were the center of American public life, places where people didn't just drink, but did business, shared news, debated politics, and built communities. This Sunday, the Time in the Valleys Museum is hosting a virtual program that takes us closer to these early gathering spaces and their outsized role in shaping a young nation. I spoke with historian and author Dr. Kirsten Wood, who's presenting this program, about why taverns in the early United States were often misunderstood spaces that mattered far beyond the bar.
Early American taverns are fantastic windows into the making of the United States. They were important in the American Revolution, as many people know, but also in the early Republic, the years afterwards, which is, I think, less well known. And once you start following who went to taverns and what they did there, you can see how tavern going contributed to the country's economy, its transportation networks, and even its political culture. So the project really grows out of my fascination with how spaces that look like informal or everyday can actually carry a lot of power.
Could you describe what a typical tavern looked like and who may have been there in the 18th or early 19th century? I think maybe people have an image of an early American tavern as a rowdy drinking hall. How does your research challenge that image?
So the answer to that question is in many ways a complicated one, because one of my arguments might be said as arguing that there was no single typical tavern. Taverns varied a lot depending on where they were. In a big city, in a small town, at a country crossroads, they might be made out of wood or brick or stone, again, depending on local vernacular architecture. But to the point that you're asking about the drinking culture, yeah, people in the early Republic, particularly men, particularly white men, drank a lot. American drinking peaks in the 1830s, to the best of our information. And so you would have found a lot of people drinking a lot. But one of the things I found is that you would also find people who were drinking very little or not at all, so that tavern going didn't necessarily mean excessive drinking. It could, but it didn't have to. Tavern going also encompassed a broader range of people than we typically think of. We typically think of white men, adults, people who are in charge of their own time. And in fact, there were sometimes women in taverns and not just women who might be considered unrespectable women, but, for example, women travelers, women conducting business. And so the people in taverns were more diverse than we might have expected in a variety of ways. And the activities they did there were also more complex than the idea of taverns as bars would suggest.
Yeah, they were more than just a place to grab a drink, as you write about taverns as spaces for business and social networking, political activity. Can you give an example of how a tavern may have been used for some of these purposes?
Yes. So the patterns that I see show that people use taverns for things like organizing mutual insurance societies, like fire insurance societies, or you might gather at a tavern, like what I found in Walpole, New Hampshire, to set up a horse thief detecting society. So these are people who are getting together for a kind of mutual improvement society. And mutual improvement can take other forms as well. It can be cultural. So people who teach dancing, for instance, which was an important genteel accomplishment in the early 19th century, might go from small town to small town offering dancing lessons. And one of the places they would do that in would be in taverns, which would have large rooms that would be suitable for holding a dancing class and eventually a dancing performance or a dancing ball. And so you would go to a tavern to take your dance lessons and then acquire the social capital that comes along with being a good dancer, for instance. You could also go to a tavern to try to solicit people's subscriptions for or contributions or purchasing stock for a stock company to create a turnpike road. You could even hold medical society meetings. One of the things that I found most surprising was that some of the early New England and New York medical societies would have their annual meetings in taverns, even as they're also typically, we typically see doctors in this period suggesting that people are drinking too much and should drink less. Their ability to meet in taverns, again, suggests the complexity of taverns as more than just drinking spaces. Mm.
How did taverns fit into the growing transportation network of young United States?
Right. So most transportation through much of the country is, of course, by road. People are traveling by foot, on horseback, or by wagons, or by stagecoaches, which are commercial. And traveling that way means taking frequent breaks to rest, to get food and water for yourself and also your animals. And so taverns are really important nodes in transportation by road. Taverns also become important as places to switch between lines as more and more people get involved in as passengers in commercial transportation, stagecoach lines, but also early steamboats and even early railroads. Taverns serve as transit stops, if you will, the station where you would leave one line, go to another line. And we see transportation companies, stagecoach companies, steamboat companies, listing the names of taverns where they stop and where passengers can then transit from one line to another. So they play a really important role there, even for railroads early on, where the very early engines can only travel a limited number of miles, 15 miles or so, before they have to get more water, for example. And so the watering stations are often early taverns. It takes a while before the railroad companies themselves start building their own hotels. That's a later in the 19th century development. But in the very early years, when it's not even clear that railroads will work in the U.S., because the U.S. is so very different geographically from Great Britain, taverns play a role there in providing basic ancillary services to the transportation companies.
Do you see parallels in today's society of public gathering spaces and the taverns of the early United States?
So there's no single institution that combines everything taverns did. We would have to have a place that was a hotel and a public library and a coffee shop and a community center and a convention center and in some ways also the like an online platform. We have divided the functions of taverns across all these different institutions and more. These are places where today people travel, meet, share news, do political work and network and do entrepreneurial work as well. What's What continues, though, what I think is similar today, is that the ability to safely enter and use any of those spaces I just mentioned, the libraries, the hotels, et cetera, shapes your economic possibilities today, your sense of belonging as a citizen, and even your ability to leverage that citizenship. So that, I think, is the key similarity between taverns then and now.
And if folks want to explore this further, of course, you're hosting a virtual program for the Time and Valleys Museum coming up this Sunday. Are there other areas they should look to understand tavern culture in early America? Your book, of course, is one place.
Oh, golly, there are so many possibilities. So there are, thanks to the digital world, there are a lot of places that have great online exhibits or walkthroughs of taverns. So, for example, the Elmendorf Inn, which is not all that far away. It's on the wrong side of the Hudson from you all. But in Red Hook, New York, has a great historic tavern site with a walkthrough and the ability to use digital technology to walk people through a historic tavern that they might not be able to visit in person, I think is a really valuable tool for people who want to learn more about what the space would have looked like. There's a similar one for the Eagle Tavern in Watkinsville, Georgia. And I think those resources are a lot of fun. Then there are any number of scholarly books that I think approach things from another angle. So, for example, there's an interesting book by Matt Osborne about, I think it's called Rum Mania, which is about people who got the DTs, delirium tremens, and because of excessive drinking. And I think that provides a nice alternative look to my book. So my book talks about taverns and their uses by improvers, by entrepreneurial types, by politically active types. And in a sense, you could say it provides a rosy view of what taverns could be. And then Osborne provides a reminder of the real costs of excessive drinking. And both stories are true, happening at the same time. And they taken together, they speak to the real dynamic complexity of the early republic and I think help illuminate why tavern politics becomes so fraught and why this space becomes so contested, because there are people using taverns to leverage their claims to respectability and power, and people seeing taverns as places that ruin people's lives and lead to premature deaths, for example. And again, both stories are true. And so people in the 1830s and 40s and 50s are wrestling with this set of complicated facts.
Is there one story or fact about taverns that tends to surprise people when they hear it?
Well, I think one thing that surprises people is just the amount of serious business that happens there. Again, the amount of capitalism in fairly advanced forms that's happening there. So people are doing a lot of business in stockholders' meetings, for example, are happening in taverns. And there are some interesting reasons for that. But I think another kind of story that's really surprising to a lot of people is the ways that some quite unexpected people are able to leverage some of these new genteel spaces, these spaces that are meant to be not rowdy, tobacco-filled, drinking, swearing spaces, but spaces that are meant to be a bit more, quote-unquote, refined. So, for example, there's one instance I found of an enslaved man from Tennessee who, with a friend, manages to escape from his plantation near Nashville. And they pass as free men of color, and they stay in two taverns where they are able to use tavern parlors as a way to stay away from the rowdy, drunken white men at the bar. He's very explicit about that. And the fact that these tavern parlors exist and that they're allowed to patronize them as supposedly free black men, in the way that this story is told by Jermaine Logan, is part of how they get to freedom. They get across the Ohio River and get into a so-called free state. And this is a really unexpected story. We don't expect to see enslaved men being able to pass for free and then pass for genteel as well. But this is a great instance of that.
Fascinating history. That's Dr. Kirsten Wood. Their virtual program, Taverns in the Early United States, takes place this Sunday at 2, hosted by the Time and the Valleys Museum in Grahamsville. more information by emailing info@timeandthevalleysmuseum.org. Dr. Wood, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, for nearly a decade, Farewell Party has been a part concert, part remembrance event at the Muse. Ahead of the event this weekend, or this Friday, Rachel Garnier talks with culture reporter Valerie Manzi about the musicians we lost in 2025 and the community that gathers to remember them. That's next on Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, you've seen Venezuelans around the world celebrating the takedown of former President Maduro, but inside the country, the streets are silent. And in the rest of Latin America, there is anger. We provide the necessary context. That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This week on This American Life, 10 months after the fall of the brutal dictatorship in Syria, a group of Syrian comedians decides to go on a national tour. But it is really not clear what they can say with their newfound freedom, or it's still going to get them in serious trouble.
I don't think something bad will happen to us. Nobody cares about us. I'm not George Clooney. It's a few people telling some jokes. Let them.
Turns out, some people don't want to like them. That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Rachel Garnier doesn't believe in quiet goodbyes. Instead, she throws a party. This Friday night at the Muse in Rosendale, Garnier returns with Farewell Party 2025, her annual musical tribute to artists who left us this past year. The show weaves together pop, jazz, rock, and folk, honoring figures like Brian Wilson, Roberta Flack, Sly Stone, and more, all through Garnier's playful and theatrical lens. The tradition began in New York City in 2016 and has grown into a cathartic, unpredictable evening where celebration and loss share the same stage. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Garnier about how the show comes together each year.
Good morning, listeners. Today, I have a wonderful guest in store for this segment of Radio Chatskill, Rachel Garnier. And Rachel Garnier is going to be hosting an event at the Muse in Rosendale, and that is January 17th at 7:30, and it's called Farewell 2025. And it is an annual tradition since 2016 as a tribute to departed musical artists, correct?
Yes, that is true.
So tell us what you have in store.
Well, as you were saying, it's tradition that started in 2016 in New York City at a place called Pangea, which is a lovely East Village downtown listening space, a cabaret space. And in 2016, it was quite a momentous year. We lost artists Prince, David Bowie, Leonard Cohen, Mose Allison,
oh, wow.
I believe, Sharon Jones, all these people. And at that point, I decided we need to have a party to celebrate these people. It was also, a time in American history that people, my friends particularly, said we need to get together. So every year, I've become a little bit of a, I don't know what to call it, a ghoul. My friends text me, guess who died this year?
Oh, yeah.
So it's always like I'm keeping records. This past year, 2025, we lost artists such as Brian Wilson, Roberta Flack, Sly Stone, Connie Francis, Ozzy Osbourne, and tragically wonderful person and songwriter Jill Sobule. And every year it's a chance to go back and kind of look at the popular culture of course, every year has its own personality as a time. So there's always folding in the present and the past. There's always this funny opportunity to explore heavy metal into jazz, into pop radio hits. We also lost Sheila Jordan, an incredible jazz singer. So I'll be saluting those people, Flaco Jimenez as well. And it's always an unpredictable evening.
Do you play their music?
I will be playing songs, selections from each of those artists, yeah. So it's an entire show. It's sort of a thrill ride and a roller coaster. I'll have the wonderful musician Dave Hofstra accompanying me on bass and tuba. And I play accordion and piano and banjo and guitar and whatever else I can get my hands on. And I love to explore the songs, you know, and interpret them. And it's a chance for me to every year become acquainted with a whole batch of songs that I've never played before. So it's always exciting in that sense. And it's an emotional thing to say goodbye to artists that we've loved, or at least artists that have been part of the consciousness. Particularly, this is a very American show, I must say.
And you are experienced with a range of musical genres and instruments, correct?
Yes, yes. I would say for the past, gosh, I'm not even going to say how many years because I'm bad with numbers. In particular, I picked up the accordion as sort of a joke, and I like to say that joke backfired. And one of the reasons being that the accordion is an instrument made to travel, and it's really traveled pretty much all over the world. And for this reason, I became very interested in so many genres, including, you know, a lot of the Cajun Zydeco music here, the klezmer music, Tex-Mex music, all sorts of European music, the tango from Argentina. So I like to work in many of these influences because they're all beautiful.
And when did you become interested in music?
Well, I would say probably my whole life. My mother is a classical piano player. So I grew up my whole life hearing her play, hearing chamber music rehearsals in the apartment where I grew up in New York City. So I've always been exposed to sounds and music and rebelled against the classical music form, but, you know, always had those sounds and feelings ingrained. So I've been interested, I would say, in every kind of music since I was a really little kid, listening to the radio, experiencing the arrival of punk rock into New York, you know, culture, not really drawing any lines between the genres.
It's all music.
Exactly. It's all music. It all speaks to some part of America, you know, of our emotional range.
Tell us a little bit about VKB.
Oh, VKB, also known as Vicky Cristina Barcelona, is a group that it's myself, Amanda Homey, and Kirsten Thien. All of us are songwriters. I write my own songs and play those as well. But all of us in that group are songwriters. We have chosen to interpret Tom Waits' songs. I should say we redecorate those songs in three-part harmony, being the feature of the sound, and doing our very own arrangements. So that's been a group I've really had a great time working with the last years. We travel a lot, and we're very lucky to travel in Europe, and we just have lots of fun.
Well, I was fortunate enough, as I talked with you previously, to see you perform up at Franklin Stage a couple of years ago. My husband and I were duly impressed. It was a fabulous show.
Oh, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Again, there is definitely an element of theater that comes into that group, and that is also an element that I'm very fascinated and comfortable with incorporating into all the shows that I play. It's performance. I spent many, many years as a busker on the streets and subway platforms in parks in New York and other cities across the sea. And there's something of that energy of just performing on the street for whoever. It's not geared to one person or one demographic or one sort of sphere or strata. So that is something that really means a lot to me, is just how do we engage with people and listeners and maybe being surprised by what songs and music people respond to.
Yes, and you know, we could see some of your theatrical bent right on the Muse promotion of the event. I love this photograph of you with that little piano and that great outfit you have on.
A little toy piano. Yes, the photo by the amazing photographer, Albie Mitchell, who's just wonderful. Yeah, that's a little shout out to some of the classic cabaret style. It's a little bit poking fun, which is important to me. Their sense of humor is super important. I mean, as is, you know, real emotion and tears and serious, quote-unquote serious feeling. But to me, it's all these sides of the same coin. And I like to have two sides of the coin, but also important is the edge of the coin that rolls and moves and is not necessarily heads or tails. It's just part of it.
Well, I love that. And what do you have coming up next?
Well, besides the Muse show happening this coming Saturday, the farewell party show, then we're getting ready with VKB Band to go to Europe for the month of March. We'll be in Scandinavia and Germany and Austria and Switzerland. So that's going to be a lovely adventure. I actually have an album that's going to come out in March, but I'll be releasing some singles from that. I'm very excited about that album. That's going to be Stand Clear Music is the label, and the record is a collection of a bunch of cover songs and a couple of songs that I've written. And that's got a beautiful sound. So I'm excited about that for this year.
Well, that's nice to look forward to in 2026.
Yeah.
So let's just restate the time and place. It's Farewell Party 2025, and it's a tribute to musicians that we lost this year. And it's January 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the Muse. And you can go to the Muse website and you'll get all the information, and you'll see this fabulous photograph of Rochelle.
And I must say as well how grateful and appreciative I am, and as is VKB Band. We love the Muse. That is a wonderful venue. It's got a real community feeling, and it's a great place to come and hang out. And the port for the community and the artists and the music and the connection is really a special thing. And actually reminds me of a lot of the places we play in Germany. There are these cultural centers that spring up in an unlikely zone, you know, and it's a really nice feeling to play a venue like that. So.
Well, we're fortunate to have the Muse and folks in the art that dedicate so much of their time and energy to bringing this kind of music and creative sharing into the Catskills.
Yes, it's so beautiful.
Yes, it is. Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with us, and enjoy the Saturday show at the Muse.
Thank you so much for having me on the air. It's a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi. That's all for us here. We'll see you tomorrow on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
In 1957, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. traveled to Ghana, where he witnessed the birth of a free African nation and deepened his commitment to global liberation. Celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. King with a look back at this historic event with MLK, the Pan-Africanist, a special program from WNYC in partnership with New York's Apollo Theater that bridges the global past to our shared present through conversation, performance, and reflection.
Monday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. We'll be prepared for some slippery road conditions developing this afternoon and this evening as rain moves in. Periods of rain and then snow overnight, accumulating 1 to 3 inches, impacting the morning commute. Today's high 38, tonight's low 29, and tomorrow again, snowy conditions through the afternoon.